One thing that's been missing is that translation of those requirements that are out there from these standards into an actual standards for the project itself. These are design standards. These are pattern libraries for use in coding. You can have all of these set up prior to the beginning of development. And if they're already in place, then that gives the designers something to pull from, and they don't feel like you're going in there and making changes to their designs mid-design, because that's the most costly type of fix, is to try and fix something once it's already been started working on it. If we can get those some standards and requirements into place before that work begins, then we won't have to redo the work later down the road.
From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we have Jason Nakai to chat about practical implications of implementing accessibility on websites and software. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Today's episode is sponsored by the Performance Matters Conference, the first annual hashtag PerfMatters Web Performance Conference is taking place in Redwood City, California, halfway between San Francisco and Silicon Valley. This year's conference is March 27th and 28th, with a full-day workshop on March 26th, helping those newer to the web performance field get up to speed, pun intended, on everything they need to know to get the most out of the two-day conference. Featuring diverse experts in the field of web performance with three talks on accessibility and performance, tickets are on sale now. A 50% workshop diversity discount is available to ensure the conference isn't out of reach. Register now at perfmattersconf.com. That's P-E-R-F matters, C-O-N-F.com. Hope to see you there. This episode is also brought to you by our friends at Focus Lab. On September 20th, 2017, a hurricane of unprecedented strength left the people of Puerto Rico trapped without power, water, communications, and access to food. 5 months later, conditions are slowly improving, but thousands are still living in darkness, unsure what the future holds. Help us turn the tide. Focus Lab is selling a shirt designed to honor the strength, love, and resilience of the Puerto Rican people. All proceeds from this campaign will be donated to Unidos, a program by the Hispanic Federation. And Bright Umbrella is matching up to $500 of shirt sales. Buy a shirt, help Puerto Rico. Learn more at focuslabllc.com/PR.
Today, we are returning to the topic of web accessibility, this time focusing less on the tech and the requirements for different guidelines and more on the practical challenges of an accessibility project. Things like project management, client expectations, and then even planning for actual development and testing. Joining us today is Jason Nakai, a software engineer who loves producing accessible and intuitive products that people enjoy using. Currently, he is the information architect and usability engineer on a large-scale healthcare project, and he recently worked with Bright Umbrella on WCAG accessibility for a college website. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thank you all for having me.
Absolutely. So Jason, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Sure. I am a tech generalist from the dark ages. I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico with my beautiful and brilliant girlfriend and our three cats.
I think our listeners should know that his beautiful and brilliant girlfriend is me.
Yes, yes, it is. Full disclosure. But aside from spending time with my girlfriend and cats and work, I run a lot. And I usually have one or two projects at the moment going on at any given time. So that's basically what I do.
And you actually have your first, is it your first ultramarathon or your second ultramarathon coming up this weekend?
Yeah, that's currently taking up my one or two projects at the moment, is preparing for a 55K race this Saturday, which I'm really, really looking forward to. I've been been training for about 6 months to run that. And yeah, it's been a long 6 months.
In terms of your tech generalist from the dark ages, how did you actually get started working on the web and in tech?
Oh, yeah, that's a really convoluted story. But a short version, I didn't start working in the web until about 1998. I actually was a parachute rigger in the U.S. Army. I was working for the 82nd Airborne Division for a few years. And I was getting ready to get out and realized that I couldn't really do too much with parachute rigging on the outside. So I extended my enlistment and changed my job field to multimedia illustration. And through that program, they sent me to art school. I learned how to draw. I learned how to paint. After that, I went to graphic design school. So I learned how to apply all of those skills I learned previously, digital area. During that time, the pen tool became my best friend, which I still today count as one of my most valuable skills, is to use the pen tool. And after that, I went to a sort of a multimedia course where I was able to package all of these things I had learned into an application at the end or a presentation. When I was working for the military, primarily I worked on information kiosks. Also created a bunch of information displays. So those were basically what I mainly did. And plus I did a lot of Photoshop retouching. So that's sort of how I got into the digital part of things. You know, once I got out of the military, I started working for a couple of startups. During this time, I was doing mostly graphic design. So I took on the job. I went home. I bought a book, PHP and MySQL in 24 hours. And I went through the book for a whole weekend. And that was my first introduction to the web.
Yeah, the old school days when we just taught ourselves everything.
And we still used books.
Exactly, books. Yeah. Well, that was a big thing back then, you know. And I think that's still a problem today. It's hard to get the training that you need to deal with today's problems and issues through traditional forms of education. You know, schools don't move as fast as the needs of technology moves. So luckily, I feel lucky to have grown up in that era because, you know, that basically formed the way I approach my job today, which is constant learning. You know, you never stop mm-hmm. learning. And luckily, the way I got into it sort of taught me that.
Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and get into today's episode. So we already talked about the basics of web accessibility in an earlier episode with Gregory Tarnoff, and we'll make sure to link to that in our show notes. For our listeners, if you haven't tuned into that one, definitely, I think it's worth listening to that one first before this one. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of about the basics of web accessibility. Jason, you're working on right now some software accessibility. How does that differ from web?
Well, that's actually a great question. And that's a question that I seem to run into on a weekly basis on this current project that I'm working on. You know, the whole new requirement of WCAG 2.0 standards for the government just recently came into effect this January. So it's still very new for this type of project. But not to say that accessibility standards haven't been around. The 508 standards have definitely been out for some time now. But with this new requirement to also adhere to the WCAG 2.0 standards, it has sort of given a little bit more weight to the accessibility issues. So that has been, again, still new, but definitely a positive I can see. Mm-hmm. So get back to that question. So there was a lot of debate when WCAG 2.0 first came out. It was being promoted as a standard that could also cover non-web-based software applications. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of people who were involved in that standard that, you know, raised their hand and said, no, this isn't a one-to-one comparison. Some of these things don't translate just across the board from a web page to a standalone application. There's some things that either don't pertain to a standalone application, or if they do, it does so in a different way than what was stated in the WCAG 2.0 standard. Again, I'm using this acronym WCAG for your listeners. It stands for the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, and this is a standard put out by a subgroup of the W3C.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me a simple example of that? So maybe something where WCAG says you have to do something, but that doesn't apply in a software environment.
Sure. There are quite a few things. Let me give you a little bit more background on this really quick. So once that the people that were involved with the standard and they're raising issues they had with applying it to software, that prompted the formation of a task force, WCAG task force. And this was basically tasked with creating working group notes, sort of a a revision to the WCAG standard, an addition, basically.
Or like an amendment or something?
Yes, an amendment. Thank you. And basically, it's applied to non-web information and communication technologies. And this here, it's, well, the title is the WCAG 2.0 to Non-Web Information and Communication Technologies Working Group Note. Basically, the task force determined that there was only a subset of WCAG 2.0 standards that applied to software. And they also noted that there were some changes that in the standards that applied to software as well. So they put out this working group note that sort of condenses some of those that apply specifically to software. And again, guidelines are just that. They're guidelines. They're not, you know, hard and fast rules, and a lot of it does take some interpretation of how that applies to the project that you're working on. So there is still some of that as well.
And can I ask a question? This task force, this working group, is that the federal government or is that with the standards body, W3C?
All right. That's another great question, because that is specific to how the W3C handled that issue.
Oh, okay.
But there are also, especially if you're working, which I am right now, with a federal project, something that's paid for through the government, or at least has some government funding involved in it. There are federal guidelines that we have to follow that are based on the WCAG guideline. I mean, you know, the WCAG standards. But they have their own set of standards that are approved by a whole different body. And this is called the U.S. or the United States Access Board. And they're the ones who make the final ruling on what the official 508 standards are for the government. So they put out the ruling, and that's the ruling that came into effect this past January.
Right. The ADA requires that WCAG 2.0 be included in that, right?
Correct. So you can actually find this document on the Federal Register. It's called the Information and Communication Technology Standards and Guidelines.
Okay, cool. So can you highlight something that might be in there that maybe would surprise people? Like, you know, that whole, well, the web doesn't apply to this software situation, so we're going to take this different approach or not consider that required guideline?
Yes, and I don't know if you've read the WCAG guidelines and some of that. It's
of
very,
course I
it's,
have.
Yeah, I forgot who I was talking to for a moment. But, you know, some of them are very, the language isn't that accessible to most of the people. So one of the things that was surprising to me was meaningful sequence. I don't know if you all are aware of that. And basically it's saying that any content you put on a web page should be programmatically presented in an understandable format, basically. So that pertains heavily to web page content, you know, which is web pages are based on HTML, which are based on delivering documents and basically adhere to a document type structure. Whereas software, a lot of times, or applications, a lot of times, don't necessarily follow that same pattern. A lot of times you might be presented with sort of like a framework interface that wraps components, individual components inside that interface. And so there's no real
sequence
of actions that you're presented with there. So that's one thing that this one wasn't actually exempted. It was just modified to make sure that whatever actions they're taken does make sense.
Oh, so the individual actions within, say, like a dashboard of 12 actions?
Correct.
The individual actions have their own sequence?
Yes, or individual components or individual processes. So say if it's a sequential process, like an ordering process or an approval process, then that should have a meaningful sequence that follows that. But if you're presented with an interface just on the screen, that's not a requirement for that.
Okay. So that's interesting. I was not aware of that nuance. Are there any misconceptions you have come across when it comes to implementing accessibility, especially from like a developer perspective, the people who have to modify the software to implement these requirements?
Oh, yes. There are definitely some obstacles in dealing with this. But I'd say a lot of it has to deal with how accessibility is approached in the project itself. So ideally, in an ideal situation, we'd be dealing with all new development. So we'd be building a brand new application. Then we could choose the software that we'll be using, or the, you know, the platform that we'll be building it on. We can choose and set up all the standards that we're going to buy. And we basically have control of what's going into this application and what's coming out of it. Big problem with dealing with large-scale applications, and especially some of these government applications or, you know, applications that are used by large industries, mm-hmm. their process, their evolution moves very, very slowly. So the life cycle or lifespan of an application can, in that process, have multiple development teams that have created multiple individual components that all get incorporated into the big application that utilizes those. Mm-hmm. And that part is probably the biggest sticking point of this, is having to deal with a legacy framework. So basically, you'd be going in and trying to retrofit some of these accessibility requirements or guidelines on a system where it's almost not possible to do. Mm-hmm. Then this brings up a bigger question, and that becomes, is it more cost effective to retrofit this application, or does it make more sense to rebuild it from the ground up? And, you know, which comes along with its own benefits and its own drawbacks. You know, one of the benefits is that going forward, it'll be much more easy to maintain, and it'll be up to date with today's up to date standards. But unfortunately, like I said, with all of these applications, especially these large scale applications, their life can span decades. And it's hard to have one team work on that throughout the whole lifespan and adhere to the standards and carry that throughout the project. So that's, I'd say that's one of the biggest issues I run into in working with larger scale applications and projects.
So regarding that, do you think that really affects the client stakeholder perspective over what's realistic?
Yes, it definitely affects it. So, you know, before working with the accessibility standards, like I said, have existed and have been promoted more and more lately. But at best, they're still more of an afterthought. And at worst, they're viewed as an obstacle to be navigated or avoided. You know, this is a big generalization that I'm, you know, for sure. But in my experience, it's happened enough to for me to comment on. And I, you know, I understand it. You know, if accessibility hasn't been incorporated from the start, then technically it is sort of an add-on. And this will also then create a disruption into whatever process is already in place. So if developers are used to code into a certain set of standards that aren't meeting the accessibility requirements, once we add those in, it's going to change their standards, and they're going to have to change the way they're working or change the way they basically change their whole work process. And this, you definitely get pushback on that. But that can be avoided by bringing accessibility into the project as a major goal from the very beginning of the planning of the project. The biggest thing I can think of is you want to get involved in the planning process of the project as soon as you can. You want to have as much time ahead of any development cycles that begin to be able to put a plan in place, and then to also start, you know, training your team.
Yeah, and getting everyone on the same page.
Yes. You know, ideally what you would want to do is set up some standards and guidelines based on the requirements, and being the person who's sort of been tasked with that, I want to make that as easily understandable to my team. After that, then I'll create some reference materials for my team to, so that way they can access that and keep it in the top of their mind. And then I would make sure to conduct training with the entire team. This would be actually be broken down into sort of like three different specific training types. One would be general for the whole team, and one would be for more designer developer focused, and then another one would be related to testing.
You know, before you go more into that, I'm curious, should there be training at the executive level or the decision maker level? Because I'm thinking about the project that we all recently worked together on. We did a college website that needed to be WCAG 2.0 AA. Leia consulted on the design, and Jason and I did the front end, but Leia only consulted on the design because they had already basically bought a design from another agency, but they never talked to that agency about making the design accessible. So it was essentially like after the fact that the accessibility got brought in. And, you know, on a website, it needs to be brought in at the design phase. And I feel like in retrospect, from the start, the whole team vibe was disconnected because the marketing department had purchased this design and had gone through all of their own internal getting approvals from the board of directors and the president of the school and all that other stuff. And then they come to find out, oh, well, this needs to be WCAG. And I think from that point forward, we really struggled to get buy-in for accessibility, even though it was part of the scope of the contract. So, I mean, I guess my point is, like, how do you get that stakeholder, that executive level buy-in, when they might have that perspective of accessibility being an add-on or not as important, and not really understanding why the approach needs to be different than that sort of bolting on at the end?
Yes. You know, like I said before, that has been my experience, that was been a very hard concept to get across to not just the executive level, but, you know, everybody on the team. But luckily, like I said, it's been my experience that right now, the contracts that I'm involved with, they have taken this into consideration, pretty much driven by the mandate that was issued in January that all software needs to meet these new standards put out. You know, so this is all still very new, and it's still coming out, and there's a lot of people that aren't quite aware of all of the changes that have been made. So, but luckily, the word has been out. So there's a lot of curious people who are seeing this and are actually reaching out to get more information on this. And so that means I've been having a lot more meetings trying to explain some of the reasons why this is important. But like I was telling you before, you know, there's levels of these accessibility guidelines that are out there. You know, like there's the WCAG one, which is, you know, from the W3C, you know, and then there's the other one that comes through the actual Access Board, the United States Access Board. And then the next level of chain of command would be the division, so, or the department. So for the current one I'm working on, that falls under the Health and Human Services standards. So they have their own set of standards that we have to follow as well. And then below that, there's the agency level standards, which would be whatever agency underneath the Health and Human Services Department is requesting this project or this product.
And so when you have that kind of all those levels, are there competing priorities?
I wouldn't say competing priorities, but what it does is it gives us a clear chain of command that I can actually use to go back and say, this is why this needs to be done.
Oh,
so I can go out to the very top, to the U.S. Access Board, and say, this is how, where it pertains to the project we're working on. But a good thing about this sort of hierarchy and chain of command is that it eventually gets down to the point where what is most immediate. And what is most immediate usually is what's contained inside the contract. So whatever's contained inside the contract for this specific product, that's the requirements that we meet initially, and then sort of branch out from there and see what else we can, what other value we can add to it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But luckily for these contracts too, there's also a template that's usually included with these contracts. And this template's called the VPAT. And the VPAT stands for Voluntary Product Accessibility Template. And basically, this is a template that lists out all accessibility requirements for the project inside sort of like a spreadsheet. And what that does, and it gives us a chance to then go through and address each one of those standards and say whether or not it pertains to the project. If we feel it doesn't pertain to the project, then we need to give an explanation as to why we feel it doesn't pertain to the project. If it does pertain to the project, then we basically lay out our plan for addressing that specific standard. So this is something that's included into our contracts. So basically, I can take that almost as a guideline that's already prepackaged for us. And since this is the closest as far as those standards are to what we're doing, you know, it's at the contract level. It's something that I can also use sort of as an explanation to anybody on our team. I'm like, well, it's part of our contract, so it's a requirement. So, you know, for me, it was very important to get a grasp of what the requirements were for the contract. What was the actual wording used in the contract? How did that pertain to the next level of standards? And how did that pertain to the next level of standards and so on? So I had to basically follow that all the way up through the chain to make sure that I had the backing and I could explain to stakeholders why a certain thing was being done the way it was being done, or why something needed to do, you know, needed to function the way it functions. So,
yeah. So, Leah, I think that kind of hierarchy or kind of reference point of why we needed to do something is something that would be useful to think about for a web accessibility project. Almost extending the discovery process to include client education.
Right.
I mean, for you, for example, the design consultation, that process, if you could describe it a little bit, it was met with a lot of resistance, your feedback on trying to make those design that had already been developed without accessibility in mind to make it more accessible.
Right. So what was interesting about this particular project is even though the design was already accepted, at the beginning, we said we might need to have changes for accessibility. I think there was a misconception, though,
yes,
what that the amount or the scale of changes would be. I think they just thought we'd adjust maybe a font size here or there, mm-hmm. or like maybe one color.
Yeah. And I think we lacked the knowledge of how important color and typeface were to them. You know, that
right.
those, they had gone already through multiple approval processes to land where they were. So for us saying, well, right. you just changed the color, that was a big deal to them, even though we didn't perceive it to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the challenges of that, it wasn't like we dismissed the brand cues and items. When I was doing the testing of their base brand colors in terms of contrast, and if it gave me a low score, I came up with an alternative that I thought was the closest possible shade that could match, that would be a lot more accessible. The issue is, I think we underestimated how tightly invested some clients will be on specifics, especially when it is a marketing team. They do look into the design details, such as, you know, the color choices and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think at the very, very, very beginning, it would have been best to say that, like, some of these changes is a larger scale than you might think.
Right.
And we could have also done better in maybe pushing the timeline. So that could have been a little bit more thoughtful. In regards to that, not that we weren't thoughtful, it was just more because we were tied to a specific timeline. We were obviously trying to fit that timeline. So we were kind of forcing the client to accept, like, just accept our decision. And that caused tension.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think it would have been useful to kind of, as Jason was describing, how he went through the contract and identified what from the different levels or the hierarchy of requirements applied to that contract. You know, I think part of that process of extending our time frame in the beginning could have included right. really breaking some of this stuff down for them. Like, why are we making this choice? Not just your contrast has to be, and I can't remember the ratio off the top of my head, but your contrast has to be so and so, but what this means in terms of the accessibility to a user, and really trying to get them on board with each of the individual rule or guidelines. Cause I felt like I kept giving them the guidelines, and the IT department who was driving the accessibility investment were like, yeah, great, cool. And marketing was like, I don't really care.
Right.
I don't care that that's the guideline. What does right. contrast have to do with my business goals? And I think that's right. where we were missing things, because I don't think we realized we needed to still do essentially sales, you know, really sell right. the marketing department, this other level of stakeholders in the project on why the accessibility was important. So in retrospect, I feel like we could have done something a little agreed more time and more thoughtful and considered approach to where they were coming from.
Right. Because I think we were coming from a point of where we were, like, you and I were already invested,
yep.
and we knew the benefits, you know, just even beyond accessibility, there were certain things where it's like, well, the larger font looks better to me, actually,
right.
just objectively, beyond just making it more readable. And then us tie, like, we should always tie it back to their audience and their audience goals. And it was interesting because actually, as Emily was mentioning, the IT team was already 100% on board, and we should have been the ones to say this, but it was the IT director who was like, well, our graduate program audience is much older and they need to be able to read the information you're trying to send them. It's not all like sharp-eyed 18-year-olds.
J- Jason, did you have a similar experience?
Yes, actually. This is, again, just to reiterate why it's so important to get involved in the process of the project as soon as you can. You know, this is in the planning phases or maybe even the pre-planning phases. So basically, that way you incorporate these accessibility requirements or accessibility goals into the project from the very beginning. So once the team gets involved, you know, the developers, the designers, the testers, accessibility is already laid out inside the project and all of the project planning. So they don't really see it as an extra step. Mm-hmm. So one of the big things that I see that could help with this is the creation of standards and guidelines in conjunction with the, whoever your accessibility person is. That way, what this gives you a chance to do is to take the requirements from the contract and, you know, all the hierarchical requirements that are above that as well, and translate that into something that's understandable for the team. And that way, you then can much easier train the team how to do what needs to be done in an accessibility-friendly way without having them become defensive. It's more of a, you know, this is just part of the project, and so this is how we're doing it. And then you explain to them the why and the how it pertains to their particular jobs. Mm-hmm. I think a big disconnect that we've had recently, and, you know, it might be because, you know, a lot of these standards are, like I said, a little bit hard to read, but then there's so many out there, like, who's my real boss, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think one thing that's been missing is that translation of those requirements that are out there from these standards into an actual set of standards for the project itself. You know, these are design standards. These are pattern libraries for use in coding. You can have all of these set up prior to the beginning of development. And if they're already in place, then that gives the designers something to pull from. And, you know, they don't feel like you're going in there and, you know, making changes to their designs mid-design, because that's the most costly type of fix, is to try and fix something once it's already been started working on it. If we can get those standards and requirements into place before that work begins, then we won't have to redo the work later down the road.
I agree with that. I feel like we tried to do that a little bit on that college website project. For example, in order to support the test, well, a development and testing process, I created checklists for all of the WCAG requirements, but tried to map them to specific elements that we were building or specific pages that had certain requirements to ensure that not only, you know, when I was developing, I knew that, you know, what the requirement was for that particular component. And then also when the testing phase came along, I knew all the parts that had to test out, had to, you know, validate, whatever the word is when you test and pass the accessibility testing. But I do feel like that's something that also we tried to do, Jason, when we were building the JavaScript modules, trying to establish the base code, the HTML that you would then work with and translate into the JavaScript interactivity, having those components built in advance how we needed them built. We're attempting to go that direction, but I think it could definitely have been more thought out, more well developed.
Yes, and I must commend you all on the HTML, the markup, and the CSS that you all provided. I mean, that's the one thing that's great about working with a standards-oriented team, is that this stuff is already in place. You know, I don't have to explain to you why accessibility is important, or, you know, I don't have to explain to Leia why contrast is important. That's sort of where we come from. We come from building things from a standards-based approach. We take progressive enhancement very seriously, so we've got to make sure that at the very base, you know, it started off with the semantic HTML or markup, and the styling and CSS is all in place and all done well. And then on top of that, then we add the JavaScript and interaction to that. So I think dealing with a smaller team that, like we did, that the accessibility stuff wasn't an issue. I think the problem, though, was that we were coming from designs that came from a company that didn't share the same vision of accessibility that we had. And, you know, I think if, you know, Leia was able to get a hand in that either quicker or maybe take it over, some of those issues might have been alleviated.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk a little bit about planning an accessibility project, really defining the phases and processes. For that school site, we pretty much followed, I think, what anyone would call a waterfall approach, where each phase led to the other. And I'm curious, Jason, for the healthcare project you're working on, how has that team approached the planning process? What's working? What hasn't worked? Because you mentioned this is all brand new.
Yes. Let's see. Currently, like I was saying, ideally, there's a progression of steps that I would like to follow. You know, that would be, again, getting in there as early as I can, understanding all of the requirements, understanding the project, its scope, and its overall goals. That would be ideal. Unfortunately, in this current project, I wasn't brought in until it had already got going underway. And so by the time I was completed with my onboarding and everything, development was going to begin sort of like the next week. So I didn't have much time to put in any of these guidelines together. I didn't have any time to conduct any training. I did do one very high level training just on accessible document creation, but that's not quite, you know, that didn't really pertain to the actual development of the software itself. So in that case, where I got embedded was with the testing team. Since development was going to be started in the next week, I needed to make sure that I could at the very least catch any issues in the testing phase and bring those back to the developers before that was completed. So what that meant is I was actually involved in day-to-day weekly sprints, and I was part of the testing team. And at that point, you know, our testing team was still being built. So, you know, I was doing a lot of functional testing. Since I'm also the usability engineer, I was also doing usability testing. And at the same time, I was also doing the accessibility testing. And again, this was daily in our sprints. We had 3-week sprints. So this was very time consuming, trying to sort of approach this project by like catching the tiger by the tail, basically, and trying to work my way up to where I could actually start, you know, getting ahead of this project rather than trying to play the catch up role.
You mentioned sprints. Does that mean it's like following like an agile process?
Yes, for this one, it's we are following an agile process. There are, I wouldn't say it's strictly agile because there's still some waterfall issues that are in there. But for the most part, it is an agile methodology that we follow.
And so in those sprints, can you describe it? Is it like you're focused on one, not phase, but one set of functionality at a time? And that set of functionality goes through development then to the different levels of testing. Is that correct?
Correct. So there's a few things I need to explain a little bit. So the sprint is basically 3 weeks of development, and this sprint will, so we basically get an item that we're going to work on. This would be some sort of component or maybe a change to the functionality of a component. And that would be become one of our backlog items. And from there, we have tasks that spawn off of that. And those tasks, if they actually then affect a user interface or something that a user would interact with, then that would require usability and accessibility testing. There was also, you know, quite a few of development and other types of activity going on that didn't require usability testing or accessibility testing because that was all sort of behind the scenes functionality. So for the sprints, basically, I would identify those that did have some sort of change or modification or addition to a user interface. And from there, those are the ones I would flag for usability and accessibility testing.
And can you explain a little bit? So the functional testing, the usability testing, and the accessibility testing, they're all separate. They're not all done together.
Initially, the way the project started out, that's the way it started, because the testers we received were primarily just testers of functional testers. They didn't really do too much usability testing, didn't have backgrounds in that or much in accessibility. So just unfortunately, the time that I entered the project, I didn't have time, like I said, to conduct any of that training. So I basically filled that role just to make sure I caught anything that was going on. But at the same time, I was creating the materials that I needed to then conduct the training. So now that we're at a point where I've actually got that work completed, I have now started training the testers and developers to go ahead and do, basically, I've been testing them how to take these guidelines of not just accessibility guidelines, but usability guidelines as well, and incorporate those into their day-to-day tasks. And that is so much more scalable than me personally trying to test every single piece of new code that comes out. So again, like I said, this wasn't ideal, but this is how we're working through it.
So the ideal would be that they're sort of doing all of the levels of testing at the same time rather than functional, then move to usability, then move to accessibility, but all of it together?
Yes, correct. Maybe not so much all together, but you know, I don't think it would require a whole separate new group of testers to come in and do that as well. Since there's already someone going in and making the functional testing, doing that, they can also be trained to also review any usability requirements that we have, as well as any accessibility requirements we have, and sort of add that to their testing suite.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that the project you're working on is like existing software, like a legacy system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, because so many aspects of accessibility have to do with a visual experience, do you have to do any design retrofit? Have you had to make compromises on the existing design to meet accessibility or usability requirements?
As it pertains to retrofit and design, yes, there is definitely some of that. So what we're doing is building new components to incorporate into a framework that is already there. So one thing we need to make sure to do, aside from making sure that all new development is completely accessible and adheres to all of our requirements, but we also have to make sure that the user's transition from the previous system into the new component isn't completely new experience, something that, you know, would completely throw off the user to the point where, you know, they might not even think they're in the same system. So basically, we had to carry over a lot of the design that was already there and make it accessible in the new stuff, in the new development. As far as our scope went for this contract, we're not tasked with going back and retrofitting the applications that we're not altering. So they're going to stay the same way they are, but we're bringing over some of the design and interaction patterns from the previous software into the new stuff to make sure that the transition for the users is as easy as possible.
Mm-hmm. Leah, what's your opinion about sort of retrofitting a design, since that's kind of what you had to do with the college website? Where do you think the easiest way to make compromises are?
Generally speaking, I think contrast in terms of font sizes, I think, is the easiest one to convince people in regards to an immediate change that actually has a pretty large impact, is trying to make sure that the font contrast, whether it's bolder or larger font sizes, is pretty easy to convey. So I think that's one of the first things that generally needs to be tackled. Also, because once you're starting to play around with font contrast and font sizing, that does affect the layout, because then containers may need to change in order to adjust to that different type of font size. But generally speaking, I think that's where it would start. Then, of course, color is important in regards to that, especially if there is some font and color issues that I do feel like was much harder to sell in the last college website we were discussing. The font sizes, they were like, yeah, sure, cool. But once we started diving into colors, that was where there was a little bit of tension. But I think what could have improved talking about that is also just focusing on the easy contrast wins first, as in, okay, we're not going to wait until we discuss changing entire background colors, but let's talk about these highlight colors. So it always seems like these little changes.
I agree. Right? I think you're totally right. I think taking it in small little increments and sort of easing them into the changes is a really smart thing that we didn't do.
Yeah. It's always in retrospect, right? Because I think, you know, as I mentioned, they took the font changes a little bit easier because they just thought, okay, you know, there's a very obvious benefit to tweaking font sizes and making certain things bold, and it doesn't do major alterations to the design. But once we were starting about color contrast, I think maybe again, if they were already into the type, I could have focused on, say, like, oh, here's how the link colors are, or here is how hovers, and, you know, just focused on like the smaller portions where it could have been tweaked and sort of colors, and then move into the larger aspects. Like, we did have to make major changes over back, like swaths of backgrounds.
Yeah, lots of. I also think it's worth noting that if you're dealing, if you're having to like retrofit a design that's just got a ton of colors, it's going to be even harder because they have a ton of colors. It's just, it's a much bigger change than, like, we're dealing with a client right now, a utility company, and we're giving them some design feedback from an accessibility standpoint, but they have like a simple blue color palette with some green. The college website was how many colors? 15?
Yeah, 15, which we dropped to 8. So that was our compromise on our end. We understand that a lot of marketing and design, I mean, I'm a designer. Of course you want to have a lot of choice, but you know, the way we sold that was, you know, in terms of consistency, you know, as well, which is important for branding and basically narrowing down the amount of color choices definitely helped with accessibility, but it was a bit of an uphill battle to get them down to that much or that little.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, in hindsight, compromise, I think, could have been introduced more into this project.
Right.
Because, you know, there is a reality, at least with WCAG websites, that if you do essentially an accessibility audit and identify everything you need to change and kind of put like a project timeline on it, you could plan to change something in a year, but you've identified it. So if you're taken to court or something, you've done enough diligence to demonstrate that you are taking steps to address the problem. And so it's kind of like a way to compromise a little bit. So, you know, you get them to pass, you know, 90% of what the WCAG requirements are, but 10% that marketing needs more time to talk to their stakeholders or whatever. Like, those could have been options had we talked to the IT department about taking that sort of approach and factored that into the project. Because that's also an option. It doesn't, I mean, ideally, you should get everything completely accessible and every page should pass, but that's not always realistic. So a way to kind of cover your butt is to do that full audit, identify everything that needs to be changed, and then essentially prioritize them and put time frames on them. Like, have an actual document that's available in case anyone were to ask. Because that's kind of a way to get you part of the way there if you're having a hard time with buy-in, especially like with they've already invested in a design.
Yes. Well, this is actually a big thing that is being utilized by me right now, actually. Sort of the way the language is stated for the new standards is that any altercation or new development has to follow those standards. So you still have that grace period, I think is what it's called, an exemption almost, of anything that's already been built prior to these requirements don't necessarily need to be updated until they're altered in any way. So for what I'm doing right now is we're building new components to put into an existing system. So those new components that we're building definitely have to be, have to meet those accessibility requirements. But the actual system that we're plugging those into does not have to, because we're not changing it. We're basically just adding something already that's to an existing framework. However, I'm trying to figure out this and trying to figure out a best way to approach this is that the steps required to go through that framework to access our new components that we're building, how do I make those accessible? And so that's a bit of a problem. So for that, that's when I've been saying that, oh, we've identified this problem. We are going to take these steps to try and rectify that problem. I mean, it's still an issue now, but we know about it and we're working on it.
Yeah, I definitely think that's something that we could have probably used to our benefit a little bit, Leah, in retrospect, of course.
Right.
You know, Leah, let's talk a little bit about, I generally feel like we've addressed the design aspect, and I think it's been interesting to have the comparison of how Jason's project is doing a little bit agile, where we took more waterfall. I feel like the actual development on the college side was pretty straightforward, build HTML, CSS, add some JavaScript, kind of standard progressive enhancement. But I feel like where we hit another challenge, you know, that in hindsight, I think we could have done better at was essentially what we call the client handover. When we're handing over the system for the, you know, we've done our QA and testing and now we're handing the system over to the client. And it's not just the front end, but also the CMS where they have right. to make their content accessible. And I feel like we should have talked a lot more about that in the beginning because mm-hmm. I don't think they were prepared for it at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I think part of it is because we were all in our own heads over like, this is how it's going to be. And mm-hmm. then they're just going to accept it. And that's not always the case. That being said, though, it's interesting. I think, you know, just in terms of communication sales and just explaining stuff, one of the benefits of us being part of the CMS build and having accessibility in mind is that we can essentially give them rules and restrict certain things mm-hmm. in order for them to, by almost default, comply with accessibility standards.
Right. For example?
So for example, the simplest thing, alt tags in mm-hmm. images, right? So in the system that we used, which was Craft CMS, you can attach fields to assets like images. And what I did was basically added an alt text field and made it required. Mm-hmm. So every time they upload a new image, they just literally have to add an alt text field. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it'll be like, warning, there is no alt text attached mm-hmm. to this asset you just uploaded, right? So that's really one simple thing. And then on top of that, I changed the listing view of all their assets to make sure that they see the alt text field. Mm-hmm. So they can see at a glance when they're just looking at all their images, which images don't have alt text and which do. Mm-hmm. So they could just do a mass review and just mass add based on that as well. So that's like one simple thing you could do within a CMS.
Yeah. I feel like we did as much as we could have done with the CMS to kind of set them up for success. Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest challenge that we saw is they just were not prepared for how much work they needed to do on their end. So
yeah, expectations.
Yeah. If you manage a website for a number of years, you've got 100 images. And what if they never, ever added alt text? So that's 100 images that are going to be in the new site. It's just a redesign. It's not like they're getting rid of stuff that have to be updated. Or, you know, this site was 5 years ago and they had some tables for layout and you can't do that in WCAG. And that those were not in CMS templates, but rather hard-coded HTML in a WYSIWYG entry. So they had to go into every single entry and make sure that everything was updated. We created a spreadsheet that said, this is an old pattern that you have on these types of pages, and this is the new pattern you need to follow that's accessible. But we just gave them one example of each, not like an entire matrix of on every page. And frankly, that's what they needed. They needed a huge matrix of all the pages that they needed to touch because it just got quickly out of hand, I think, in terms of them feeling overwhelmed rather. And also, I don't think they had a good process for their own accountability or due diligence. How many times did we get issues that were already in the queue, but no one on their team were talking to each other kind of thing? I do think we could have done something different with the client handover and setting expectations across the board.
Yeah, absolutely. And or if this is something that we had set expectations at the beginning and they were like, nope, we don't have the bandwidth for that.
Yes.
Then we could have
compromised
or built into the project budget or timeline extensions in order for another team mm-hmm. to do those mass alt tag changes, mass table changes, et cetera, and so forth, right? Because there's just so many like, what about this? What about that? That they weren't prepared internally as a small team to just do. And we also had a really rigid timeline, I think. Mm-hmm. So that really affected things if we had also set expectations that we will need to potentially expand to accommodate than, you know, again, in retrospect.
Yeah, I feel like one of the few things, so Leah and I have an internal project retrospective, and then we have one with the client. And one of the things I feel almost certain about moving forward is that if we get another project of this size and scope, this is a very large project. It involved multiple sites. The client had the budget. We should have gone on site in the beginning and done a lot of hand holding about to set those expectations, to right. do the education. And we would have gone on site at the handover at the end to assist right. them in that. And I almost right. feel like no matter what, if it's a project like this, that is part of the project. And that adds on a whole month, maybe 2 months to the overall project in order to get that complete client buy-in, setting expectations, making, because we knew what we needed to do. I think where right. things fell apart, the client didn't understand what yeah. they needed to do.
Right. Because I think we told them that they needed to do certain things, but we didn't communicate properly the extent and scope.
Yeah. So Jason, do you have similar problems? Like, let's talk a little bit about testing, especially when you kind of got brought in at the end and you were trying to do all of the accessibility on your own. Have there been some lessons learned about how to best approach it to set your development team's expectations, the testers' expectations, or anything like that?
Most definitely. And again, I sound like a broken record, but you want to get involved with the process as soon as possible. This is mm-hmm. so that, again, you're introducing these accessibility concerns from the very beginning. So they get woven into the project as opposed mm-hmm. to something that's added on. But big thing for us is we really need and we utilize an issue tracker. So this is for, mm-hmm. You know, something doesn't really have to be, you know, super fancy issue tracker, but it shouldn't be post-it notes or email threads, you know, because those things are so hard to follow up on and they inevitably fall through the cracks. Mm-hmm. So for us, we're using an agile development methodology. And through that, we're actually using Microsoft Visual Studio Teams services as sort of our project management software. And in there, we can actually utilize something for issue tracking. And since everybody on the project has access to that, we know where things are at, and we know when things get either resolved or when they need to be escalated or if they no longer even are an issue anymore. So we can actually see a real-time visualization of where those issues are at.
I think that's a good point. Leah, you and I really sort of struggled on what the best approach for this was because one of our key client testers and person responsible for updating content in the CMS is a bit on the less techie side. So we wanted something that was as kind of lowest common denominator anyone could use it as possible, but I don't think it worked as well. Yet at the same time, I'm not real confident an issue tracker would have been any better.
Well, it's one of those things where tools are interesting because certain people log on to it and absolutely love a specific one and other ones just don't resonate as well. You know, some people still love email in comparison to other project management tools. So I don't know. Like, I think it really depends on the particular client at the end of the day. And again, you know, one of those retrospect things, maybe we really need to take more seriously the idea of technical acuity of mm-hmm. the client that we're dealing with and then adjust, you know, really adjust from there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like we totally ate it on the project management of the testing phase because there was right. just so much, nope, you've already reported that one. We're already working on it and you need to check with your teammate to make sure you guys are talking first. And yeah.
FYI, it's in the documentation already.
Oh my God. That was like, Leah had to be, please refer to the documentation. Please refer to the documentation.
Well, just to touch briefly on another topic sort of pertains to this. So like I said, I joined the project a bit late. And so development was already started. So I jumped into the testing area so that way I could catch any accessibility issues that I might have already made it through the development process. But one thing that was key for me to start getting ahead of that, instead of always being on the back end, was to start attending design review meetings and other meetings such as that. So I could actually bring up these concerns at the very beginning of something when a design was just sort of actually gathering its requirements. I could bring up an issue with, did you make sure that to check font sizes or to check contrast ratios of certain things? Or, you know, luckily with these government applications, you know, people aren't really set in stone on design. You know, there was, people don't really fight you tooth and nail for design like they would on some other projects I've been on. So from that perspective, it's a little bit easier to do that.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, because this has been a pretty involved conversation, I did want to talk a little bit about like maintenance. So one of the things I think it's important to keep in mind for a project and a web accessibility project is keeping the client aware that there's a maintenance aspect to this, particularly when they're dealing with a CMS where they have a lot of control of the content. Leigh and I, in our demystifying web maintenance episode, we talked about doing like an accessibility site audit. It could be something that's like a monthly review of the site using browser-based testing tools so that you're making sure that any new content added to the CMS in the previous month still passes the requirements. And it's something that the client can do themselves, or it's something that we as the developers can provide them if they don't have the resources or the staff to handle it themselves. I definitely think it's something that is important, because if it's not done and content gets inaccessible, then all that investment's kind of, all that time and money that they spent on getting everything accessible goes away, because the reality is it's pass fail. If one thing on the page doesn't pass, the whole page doesn't pass. Mm-hmm. So in terms of that aspect of maintenance, Jason, is that where that library, the standards library that you are creating comes in to play?
Yes, it definitely comes into play in there. And that's just a sort of a pattern repository. These are patterns that we have already used and have tested and have been approved to be usable and accessible. So we'll just put those in a repository. Whenever somebody encounters the need for one of those, they can just pull it out and use it with the, and feel pretty comfortable that it doesn't have any accessibility or usability issues.
Do you do any kind of like audit, or, you know, like once something's gone through the sprint, is it just done, or does it get audited later?
So for that, like I said, we do in-sprint testing. So once a piece is complete, it goes through functional testing, usability testing, and accessibility testing before that task gets marked complete for the sprint. After all of that's done, then we're going to do another phase of testing, you know, during the user acceptance testing. And that's just, again, to make sure that that the end product is meeting the standards that were laid out in the contract.
So this has been a really in-depth conversation. Can you give us any final tips for making an accessibility project smooth and successful?
Well, actually, again, I'm probably going to just reiterate some of the things I said before. One, that's to get involved in the project as soon as you can. Two, make sure you try and train your team on this, on these concepts, so that way it becomes a team issue rather than you trying to come in and get involved after the fact. Definitely continue to learn on these things, because like I said, there's so many standards out there that a lot of teams are changing, but they'll give you notification on what are the upcoming changes are. So it's always good to keep on top of that. And then lastly, I'd say ask for guidance. If there's something you're not fully understanding or aware of, reach out to somebody, a peer, or maybe someone who's an authority on this subject, and ask them for guidance and direction they can point you in. Because it's been my experience that there's a lot of information out there, but a lot of it isn't very distinctive and clear. It doesn't really give you a distinct direction to go. So for me, I found it very valuable to reach out to people who have been doing this for a long time as well, and to get other perspectives on it.
Did you come across any good resources that did convey this stuff clearly?
Like I said, they're all over the place. There's a bunch of blogs. There's people who are really in, you know, looking into this, but I would basically go on to some of these, like the United States Access Board website. And they have a lot of articles that pertain to accessibility or stuff going on at the moment. Same with the W3C. I try and keep an eye on some of those things that are coming out from there. And then, you know, of course, I follow a bunch of accessibility and usability people on Twitter. to also just keep a finger on the pulse of what's going on out there.
I would just chime in that I do think the W3C's Web Accessibility Initiative is a really useful website. They have actual patterns that you can follow to build accessible components, including they have a whole section on interactive components, like how your underlying HTML should be structured to support accessible tabs or something like that. So the Web Accessibility Initiative is a really good resource.
Yes, and that's actually where I got the sort of the inspiration for incorporating that pattern library into our processes, because I definitely wanted to train the developers in how to develop, you know, with accessibility and usability in mind. But sometimes it's hard for them to keep that top of mind, especially if it's not something they've done for throughout their career. So If you can get something like this, set up a little repository of these patterns that they can refer to, then, you know, there's a refresher for them right there at their fingertips.
Very cool. So that's all the time we have for today. But before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better.
Okay.
Are you ready, Jason?
I think so.
Okay. First question. What's your go-to karaoke song?
That would have to be the song from Annie.
The tomorrow?
The sun will come out tomorrow. Nice. I actually have a funny story about that. I went to Brooklyn. Some of our friends took us out to a karaoke bar, and we were waiting to sign up, be the first people to sign up. And somebody signed up right before me, and he actually chose that song. It's odd that first two people want to sing the same song.
What advice would you give your younger self?
I would give my younger self the advice to not be afraid to fail. In fact, Try and fail as much as you can, because that's one way you can learn. For me, failure as a younger person was so hard to deal with, and I think it just built it up in my head. So if you can learn to accept failure and learn from it and then take that in and realize that just one failure is not the end of everything, it's an opportunity to learn.
What's your favorite PG rated curse word?
Oh, goodness. Did you hear that? That's the one that always comes out. In fact, Emily can probably attest to this. I have a bunch of them. I think good grief would probably be the biggest one.
Charlie Brown, good grief.
Good grief. I love it.
All right. Who's your favorite superhero?
That one's another hard one. But I think right now, you know, with my race coming up, I'd have to say The Flash.
What is your favorite time of the year?
That would be fall, I'd say. Fall would be my favorite time of the year.
If you can change one thing about the web, what would it be?
Oh, my goodness. I think what I would change about the web is I would want to make it more like, you know, the cyberspace reality that was described in William Gibson's novels. To me, that's what it would always be cool to see, sort of the web laid out in a physical way.
Cool. What are three words that describe you?
I'd have to say I am curious. I am passionate about things, and I get obsessed about things.
What are three words that describe your work?
My work, I'd say, has to be important to me, has to be fun to me, and has to allow me the freedom to explore new things.
What's your favorite meal of the day?
My favorite meal of the day would be, that's a hard one, because I must admit, Emily's a great cook, so, you know, dinners are always amazing, but I recently started liking breakfast more and more.
All right, last question, coffee or tea?
I'd say both. I actually drink coffee all day long, but I also drink tea. In fact, my first cup of coffee in the morning is coffee mixed with a bit of mushroom tea.
Very cool. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the show and I enjoyed being on it.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at @JNakai. And I think that's basically the only place I'm available right now.
Okay. Thanks again, Jason. This was really great conversation.
Great. It was really nice to speak to the two of you.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency invested in education and social good. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsors. Many thanks to the Performance Matters Conference and Focus Lab. Don't forget to buy a shirt to support the people of Puerto Rico.
We'd also like to thank our hosting partner, ArchisTech.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts or both. Links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we dive into project management with Rachel Gertz. Be sure to check out controlclickcast.com/schedule for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.